still rocking after all these years.
This is the story of my rock and roll butler.
This is it, the show that started it all. Often imitated, but never equal. From San Francisco, USA, online since 2004, it's the one and only Rock and Roll Geek Show. With the original rock and roll geek, Michael Butler.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Geek Show. My name's Michael Butler. Thanks a lot for joining me. I really appreciate it. Today is a bonus episode. This is an interview I did on Wednesday with a guy named Daniel Roer. He is a movie director, and I have never interviewed a movie director before. So take that for what you will, because, well, I was sent a screener of this movie called Once We're Brothers, the story of Robbie Robertson and the band. It's based on Robbie Robertson's memoir's biography called Testimony. A guy named Daniel Roer. So I was sent a screener about 3 weeks ago, and I enjoyed it. I'm into all documentaries, especially music documentaries, and I enjoyed the movie, and it got me turned on to the band's music. The band is a little bit before my time, and like I said, I had never interviewed a movie director, so I asked my good friend Dave Slusher, who has interviewed many, many movie directors. Dave Slusher, my podcast mentor and co-host of Mad at Dad, he came up with a lot of these questions. I enjoyed the movie more than Dave Slusher, but yeah. I hope you like this. It only goes about a half hour. That's why I'm making this a bonus episode. No one's getting charged. No one's getting charged on the Patreon. And if you are a donor, thank you so much for donating to the Rock and Roll Geek Show friends. And thank you for the people who arranged this interview. And thank you to Daniel Roer for spending 30 minutes of his time. Look for him. And if you enjoyed this, let him know. Find him and let him know you've heard him on the Rock and Roll Geek Show so he doesn't think he wasted 30 minutes of his time on this. All right, I'm going to play a song from the band to maybe if you're not familiar with them, this will get you a little bit up to speed. One of my favorite songs from the band. This is from an album in 1968. I was 7 years old when this album came out. This is one of their biggest hits. It's called The Wait, and I'll let this play, and after that, we'll go right into the Daniel Roer interview. It's unedited, so you might hear me stumble a few times, and you might hear Daniel Roer get pissed off at me a few times, but he seemed to take it all in stride, and I hope you enjoy it. Here is the band, and after the interview's over, I'll come back and say some parting words. This song is called The Wait.
I just need some place where I can lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me where a man might find a bed? He just grinned and shook my hand. No was all he said. Take a load off, Fanny. Take a load for free. Take a load off. When I saw Carmen and the devil walking side by side, I said, hey, Carmen, come on, let's go downtown. She said, I gotta go, but my friend can stick around. Take a load off. Moses, there's nothing you can say. It's just old Luke, and Luke's waiting on the judgment day. staying, keeping a Lee company. Take a load off Fanny. Take a load off Bree. Take a load off Fanny. And you put the load right on me. He said, I will fix your rat if you take Jack, my dog. I said, wait a minute, Chester, you know I'm a peaceful man. He said, that's okay, boy, won't you feed him when you can?
Yeah, take a load off Fanny, take a load off Bree, take a load off.
Put the load right
on me. Put the load right on me. Get your cannonball.
Hi, Michael. How was it?
Hi, Daniel. Thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Happy to do it.
So where are you? Are you in New York?
I'm in Toronto, Canada.
So you're Canadian?
Yes, sir.
Is that how you got interested in the band?
Yeah, sort of. I guess so.
How old are you?
I'm 26.
You're 26, so because I'm quite a bit older than you, and the band was a little bit before my time. How did you find the band?
Well, I grew up on the band. Every summer, my dad would take us camping, and he'd play the music.
Oh yeah,
and so would sing the music, and so that's how I came to it.
Huh. How's the lockdown going in Canada?
Resoundingly better than it is in the States, that's for sure.
Are you not allowed to leave the house or anything?
No, we can leave the house. How do I describe it? We just didn't have a situation that was as bad as New York. I think there's 100,000 total cases in the entire country, something like that, or 85,000 all over the country, and they're congregated in our biggest two or three cities. So it's not as bad as elsewhere, but for me personally, it's just been annoying more than anything, but I'm fine considering nothing's fine, and then my family's fine, and we're keeping my dad inside as much as we can. But I've been going to my little studio, which is my own little space, and we've just been socially distancing and trying to follow best practices.
All right, that's good. So when you were growing up, you said your dad got you into the band. Were you into any other bands? What kind of music were you really into when you were a kid? Because everybody's family, you know, turned them on to music. Like my aunt turned me on to Tommy James and the Shinedown, blah blah blah. And but I found my own music. What kind of music were you into growing up?
Well, I'd say growing up, most of the music I listened to was the canon of like 60s, 70s folk rock.
Oh, really?
And roll.
Huh.
Yeah, that sort of material. That's what always spoke to me. So like Neil, Joni, the band, Dylan, Crosby, Stills, Nash, artists of that ilk, I was always drawn to.
You're kind of still a kid now. So you,
some people would characterize me as such.
In school, did your friends, because your friends were probably all into like Green Day and
That's right.
What did they think of you when you were like a folk rock kid?
I don't know. I don't remember discussing it or being coming up as a part of discussion. I just knew what resonated with me, and there was something about the lyrics and the music and the storytelling quality that exists in so many of these songs that I was always drawn to. I listened to a little bit of that music. Like, I know the Green Day songs. I know Blink-182. There's some cool music there, but it doesn't stick with me like some of the stuff from the 60s and 70s.
You play an instrument, guitar or anything?
Well, only when I got the job, or rather was in consideration to get the job, did I start playing guitar and start taking guitar lessons. So I don't know how to play. I know a couple chords. I wouldn't call myself a player, but I enjoy plucking every now and again. And it's wonderful to have spent the time to at least learn the very basics.
So to get the job, you're talking about the job directing the band, the Once Were Brothers?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's right.
This movie was already, somebody was already produced, was already, this, it was already planned to be done, and they were just looking for a director?
Not exactly. I had independently put together a pretty comprehensive, what I would say, treatment or pitch of how I would make the film. Uh-huh. And
so you heard on the street or something that they were trying to put a movie together for Robbie Robertson's book?
No, I didn't hear that they were trying to put a movie together. I just assumed that it should be made. I just felt like it should be made, and I started making it.
Okay.
But of course, I was just some kid in Toronto, so I linked up with some of the some bigger producers.
Who were the big producers? Scorsese and Ron Howard and those guys?
No, White Pine Pictures and some Canadian companies.
Okay. So it was your idea. So did you read Robbie Robertson's book? Was that what gave you the idea?
Yeah, just to be clear, are we doing the interview? We're going now?
We're on, yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I read Robbie's book. I devoured it. I thought it was fantastic. And I just realized that it would make an extraordinary film. And I convinced myself that I had to be the one to make it. No one would do a better job than I would. And then I just had to convince the rest of the world of that.
Hold on, let me let my dog out. All right, sorry about that, Daniel. My dog's in here. It's like 100 degrees out here. I'm in California. It's like 102 degrees.
Whereabouts are you?
Well, I live in San Francisco, but I have a place up in the mountains. We're kind of like spending the Corova time up here in the mountains and enjoying the woods and stuff. And my dog
that's
is
awesome.
Crying to get out.
What mountains? How far away from the city?
It's Trinity County. It's the Trinity Alps. You know where that is?
No.
It's kind of near Redding. It's like an hour west of Redding. It's super nice. It's in the woods, and it's really beautiful. It's like National Forest. Good.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's great. It's kind of like the Big Pink, except the house is not pink.
Right. Good. That's awesome.
So, you who did you approach to make the movie?
Well, I had someone who's sort of representing me in Canada, and they put my name forward. But what ended up happening is that they gave the job to another director. There's a different filmmaker attached to the project, which is disappointing for me, but I'm used to disappointment, and I become resilient, and so I just figured on to the next thing. But for whatever reason, it didn't work out with that filmmaker, and they were looking for a different director. And I was standing there with a CV and a list of credits that was just a smidge above where it had to be, just to be considered. And I ended up, interviewing well at the production company, and I was going to be in Los Angeles for another job, and so while I was there, I went and met with Robbie, and as they say, the rest is history.
So how long did it take you to make the movie?
About 2.5 years.
You finished it when?
We finished it on August 29th, 2019.
Oh, so not too long. It was like last fall.
Yeah.
Did you I'm assuming you already saw the Last Waltz and all that. I'm not an authority on the band. I just let you know at the beginning. But when I saw the movie, by the way, I really liked the movie. It was really good. I enjoyed it. Thanks. I was not an authority on the band. I'm not. But it really got me into their music. So thank you for that. Now I'm a fan of the band. I'm really into it. But
that's great.
I forgot what I was going to ask you. But anyway, so did you see the Last Waltz?
Yeah, I watched The Last Waltz, you know, many, many times in high school. It was a staple for me, and I just thought those guys were so cool. I thought that each and every one of them was unique, and the music they made together sounded like nothing I had ever heard before. They just had this cool mystique to them that made me want to know more, made me want to know who these guys were, and instilled with me a curiosity and fascination that I think put me on the path to make this film.
So when you got, when you were being considered, so Robbie Robertson was interviewing people to direct the movie?
No, the production company in Canada was, but before they could hire me, they wanted to make sure that I had good chemistry with Robbie, because we'd obviously have to be working closely together. So I went down to L.A. and I met with him, and ultimately I think he liked the cut of my jib.
What was the first meeting like with Robbie Robertson? Where was it?
Well, I went to see Robbie at his studio. And Robbie's the coolest guy in every room he's in, and that's something that becomes immediately apparent. Uh-huh. And I was just struck by how generous he was in terms of not just sitting there and telling stories and occupying all of the oxygen in the room, but also he's very generous in that he's interested in where I come from, and he wants to hear my stories. And he cares about what I have to say. And so I was really struck right out of the gate of how natural our relationship was. You know, I think he respected how much energy and passion I brought to the table. And, you know, I found out later that I reminded him of himself a little bit at my age. And that was obviously a phenomenal compliment. So, you know, it was immediate from the get-go that this would be, it was a meeting of the minds, I think, and I really resonated with him.
How'd that first meeting go? Did you walk in there, your agent was with you, or who?
No, I was just there by myself. I walked in, and Robbie was in the studio. He came out, and I think I said something like, "Hey, Robbie, what's going on?" And we started chatting, and, you know, it was just story time. We talked for 2 hours, and we really hit it off, and I just said, "Listen, man, I'll fucking die if your movie's not awesome. I'll do whatever I can to make the best possible thing. I'll work like my life and career depended on it, because they really do. You know, I don't have an Academy Award nomination or fancy credits, but I have so much passion and energy for your music and for the band. You know, we can't lose, I promise you that." And I think that pitch was quite compelling for him.
Did you bring anything with you, like his book or some records to autograph or anything like that at the first meeting?
No, absolutely not. I'm not really interested in autographs. He's ever autographed anything for me, come to think of it. I'm not someone who's interested in autographs. That doesn't excite me very much. Uh-huh. So I would never ask him for that. But I think one or two times someone close to me or important to me, like my dad or something, wanted me to get the book signed, and, you know, Robbie has no problem doing that for me. So I think he got signed something from my dad way back. But no, I would not, it would not be a good look if I asked him to sign a record on that.
It probably wouldn't have been the coolest thing to do, but some guys would have done that. So the meeting went well, and then what happened after you met with Robbie? How did you go back to your hotel, and did you have a good feeling about the meeting?
No, it was like, as I was leaving, he's like, "All right, kid, let's do it. Let's make trouble together." He said something like that, which was like cool and cryptic in the Robbie Robertson way. He like speaks in song lyrics. So, you know, I knew that I got the job, and then it was just a question of figuring out how to make it happen.
Yeah. So you walked out of there, you were all happy. And how long after that meeting before you started shooting the movie?
Probably 2 months.
Okay.
We did our first interview in October.
So did you have a bunch of people lined? How did you get the people lined up to be in the movie? Did you have to contact everybody yourself?
No, Robbie's manager, Jared Levine, helped a lot with that. And Universal Music Group, who was the co-producer of the film, also obviously had connections in the musical arena, so we were able to get a lot of the interviews that way.
Did you try to get Bob Dylan to talk in the movie?
Yeah, we did, but we understood it was a long shot because Dylan's not typically one for press or to do interviews. So we were just grateful that Jeff Rose and Bob's manager was really, really accommodating and super helpful. The Dylan Archive's in great shape, and his office is staffed by, you know, just the sweetest, you know, the sweetest group of people you'll ever meet. Really were helpful and cared a great deal about the band and helping us tell the story and giving us access to really important archives.
So he turned you down then?
I don't actually know that they officially turned us down, so they don't know that we actually made an ask, but I don't think we asked. I think it was just clear that he wouldn't do it, so we didn't think to ask, but in the same breath, his representatives made it clear that they would go to great lengths to help us.
Yeah,
in spite of that.
Did you see that other, the Bob Dylan movie? I think Scorsese made that one, the Rolling Thunder. Did you see that movie?
I did, yeah.
What did you think of that?
I enjoyed it. I mean, the performance footage is great.
Scorsese,
yeah, you can't really go wrong with that music.
Scorsese did that one too, didn't he?
I believe he did, yes.
Yeah. In the movie, what struck me about Bob Dylan in your movie, the limo scene when they're getting in the limo and when they're doing when the band is playing, you know, they're doing, Bob Dylan's doing his debut electric tour with the band, and he's getting booed off the stage, and in the limo, Bob Dylan came off as kind of like an asshole in that limo scene. That's what he came off to me.
Okay.
Yeah. Did you meet Bob Dylan?
Did I meet him?
Did you meet him at least to talk about the movie? I mean, did you talk to him at all?
No, I never did. But he did watch the film, and he really loved the film.
Oh, he did. Oh, good.
He called Robbie and sent his praise to Robbie. And in my mind, it doesn't get much better than that, receiving praise from him. So, you know, that was really, really special for me.
Yeah, one thing about the movie that struck me, the Ronnie Hawkins guy, when he comes on camera... He's kind of like brings the movie to life. That guy's got a really great outgoing personality.
Oh, absolutely. I think any room Ronnie's in, he brings it to life. Ronnie Hawkins is, you know, totally an original. There's no one like him. And getting the chance to interview him, he's not super famous in America, but in Canada, even though he's from Arkansas, he's a legend. And so it was fantastic to get to... talk to him and interview him for the movie. His recollections are amazing.
Did he have any stories that didn't make the move, that didn't make the cut of the film?
Oh, dozens and dozens. I mean, everything he says is a story. He's the funniest guy you'll ever meet. So there are plenty of stories. I'm sure I can't repeat them on radio, but or on podcast. But you know, he had some phenomenal things to tell me.
Yeah, you can repeat them if you want. I mean, there's no.
Okay, good to know.
So when they're doing that, when they're at the film, or the one when Ronnie Hawkins was on talking about when they're backstage at the Fillmore, getting ready to film The Last Waltz, they spent $35,000 on cocaine, and Ronnie Hawkins said it was shit cocaine.
That's right. That's what he said.
Nothing to say about that?
Oh, well, I think it was a different time. I think that, you know, drugs were ubiquitous in a way that they are not today, certainly for my generation. And, it was a crazy time. And, you know, as someone who abstains from most vices, I don't think I would have fit in as well as Ronnie Hawkins.
When they start getting successful and the band starts getting successful, they all start getting into drugs and alcohol, except for Robbie. And
thank God.
And Garth, yeah. Well, speaking of Garth, he's not in the movie. Why did you try to get him?
Yeah, we shot an interview with Garth, but he's just quite elderly now. And for any fans of the band, they'd know that Garth has never been the strongest interview subject. Uh-huh. And so we felt that it would be best just to use archival interviews and his own music.
Okay. The first gig they play in San Francisco, Robbie gets stage fright.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, it's kind of this incredible scene. Here's a band that's been, you know, touring and on the road for, you know, almost 10 years, and this is their first performance as the band. And, you know, Robbie gets totally sick, totally ill, and there's this wonderful story in the movie where Bill Graham, who's the promoter, has this idea to bring in a hypnotist. And certainly the hypnotist would be able to hypnotize Robbie into feeling better. And it's kind of this incredible, extraordinary, amazing scene, which is augmented by this wonderful music cue, this song called Chess Fever, which is one of my favorite songs from the band's catalog.
So they get successful, and everybody, they start getting into, they start crashing their cars. Were they still living?
Yeah, that's very dangerous.
Were they still living all in the same house at that time?
I don't think that by that period they were, but they were obviously very close to one another. They were definitely had a professional and creative marriage.
Yeah, they all start crashing their cars. Then they start getting into harder drugs, start getting into heroin.
Yeah.
Did you, Todd Rundgren engineered the album Stage Fright. Did you talk to him?
That's a great question. I didn't interview Todd. I don't remember if we tried to or we just couldn't make it work. But he would have been interesting to talk to because he remembered. He was just a young guy. He was this hotshot kid from New York that they brought up to do this record. And, you know, I'm sure he would remember and speak to the difficulties that came with working with musicians and artists that were frequently inebriated and strung out.
There was one gig where the keyboard player lost his stash and he refused to play.
Yeah, that's right. Do you want me to talk about that?
Yeah, please.
Well, in the 1970s, there was not the same understanding of drugs and chemical addictions that there are today. You know, we've come a long way, and although there's still a lot of ground to cover when it comes to destigmatizing and treating chemical addiction and substance abuse, in the 70s, there was no language to describe chemical addiction as a disease. Instead, people who were afflicted with addiction were often thought as having personally failed, of being irresponsible. And I think for Richard Manuel, who was the keyboard player, the piano player and vocalist of the band, he certainly fell into that category. And it's, you know, a really, really, really deep tragedy that there was no support to help him and so many other musicians climb out from the depths of addiction and despair.
So did he play the gig? Did they talk him into playing the gig? I don't remember.
I don't think he played the gig. I think he went to the hospital. I think he was quite sick.
Oh, they played.
So he was
withdrawing. He was like dope sick. I guess it was probably heroin that he lost then.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
After the last waltz, Levon Helm kind of became bitter with Robbie Robertson, and he claimed that Robbie started taking all the credit for writing the tunes, and he felt like he wasn't getting the credit he deserved. Did Robbie talk about that?
Yeah, I discussed that with Robbie, and I think that, you know, I wasn't there, so I can't really speak to it, but all the people I've spoken to, which are all the people who were there, from the producers and, you know, stagehands, roadies, managers, and support staff for the managers, everyone, you know, tells the same story. Bobby was the one who was up early in the morning at, in his studio, busting ass, writing the songs, putting pen to paper, coming up with the words and the melody, and the group would workshop them together. That's how most of the biggest hits were written. I can't speak to, you know, the dispute that took place years later, because I don't know, maybe Lee Bonch had a different understanding of what it means to write a song, and I think that's fine, and ultimately, at the end of the day, I think what matters is the work itself. People are going to remember the song. They're not going to remember this dispute.
Okay. Robbie's wife, Dominique, she was in the movie quite a lot. Was that part of the plan, or did that just come, you know, just accidentally with the editing? She had the best stories and stuff.
Well, I think when you shoot a film, you never really know who's going to contribute what and who's going to be a protagonist and a lead character. And it just so happened that Dominique gave such a fantastic interview, and she spoke to some very challenging themes with great articulation and clarity and a clinical knowledge that I didn't expect. And consequently, it became clear that we had to put her in the film as much as possible because her voice was so strong, and she was so good she was so good in the interview. I tried hard to put her in the film as much as possible.
She's an addiction counselor, I think, now, right?
That's right.
So I guess this probably gave her good, being Robbie's wife probably gave her good experience to counsel people. I'm sure that's probably the first thing she brings up when she counsels people.
I would certainly think that there's a connective tissue between her experience with the band in her early days and how that influenced her choice later to work in addiction counseling. Absolutely.
How long have they been divorced?
I think about 20 years, maybe.
20 years. Because he came off, in the movie, he came off as this real good family man. I was wondering why they got divorced.
I don't know. I can't speak to that. You'd have to ask one of them. I don't know.
All right. I'll ask Robbie. He's coming on. Robbie's coming on next week. I'll ask him.
Great. But I think he was a great family man. And that's, I think, partially what motivated his decision to stop, end the group and stop touring.
Was there any loss since Scorsese was he's executive producer on this film, right?
That's right.
Did you get any access to any Last Waltz footage that they didn't use in the movie? That wasn't
no,
used?
No, we didn't. We didn't, unfortunately, because most of it is in a vault somewhere, and we couldn't get access to it, unfortunately.
Okay. David Geffen in the movie talks Robbie into moving to Los Angeles, and he kind of used Robbie just to try to get to sign Bob Dylan. Did he get Bob Dylan on his label?
He did, yeah.
Okay, so it worked.
And yes, I believe it did. Yeah.
Robbie ended up liking, where did he move, to Malibu, is that right?
Yeah, Robbie and his family moved to Malibu, and it must have been a crazy move for them because they were living in the woods in Woodstock, and all of a sudden they're on the beach.
Is that where he still lives, in Malibu?
No, I think he lives in L.A. now.
Okay. Hey, there's just the theme of the movie kind of is how Robbie Robertson was the rock that held the band together, and everybody else kind of fell into addictions and went into the wayside. Would you be possibly interested in doing the opposite story, Levon Helm's side of the story? I know Levon's dead, but
I don't think there's a need to do that, because I think Levon has really effectively told his side of the story. Levon wrote a great book that's lot of fun. It's a really great read. And there's also a documentary film about Levon about his later years. I love the band, so I'd watch any movie that's made about them.
Yeah.
But I won't be making that one. I think I'm banded out.
What's next for Daniel Rohan? Daniel Rohr, I'm sorry.
Rohr, no, it's okay. I have a slate of projects in development, a number of which are music-based. which is very exciting. And I'm just trying to stay inspired and work during this weird global phenomenon and make things and be creative every day.
Is this how you make your living?
Making films?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you making, how's this movie doing?
In what regard?
In financially.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Not my department.
All right.
But in terms of how well it's done critically and the reach it has, it's beyond anything I could have imagined.
All right. Well, I enjoyed the movie, Daniel, and I wish you all the best of luck in it, and I will I'll watch your next movie as well. Is this your first full length?
Yes.
All right. Do you have a project signed that you're working on now?
I'm working on another music film. I'm working on one music film, actually, about another rock and roller of a similar vintage to Robbie, who has his roots in the Bay Area. And then I'm working on a big international human rights film about art and culture in war zones. I'm working on a documentary series that has to do with music, which I'm very excited about. I can't say more than that. And then there are various other projects at different stages of development that I'm equally excited about.
So is the Bay Area musician you're doing a movie on, is that a secret?
It is definitely a secret. I'd love to tell you, but I can't.
Hmm. Is he around from the same time? All right, I would try to guess, but I won't put you on the spot.
Sure. I appreciate that.
All right, Daniel, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you, and stay safe and enjoy the mountains.
You too. Be safe from the corova out there.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Okay, bye. All right, there you go. Daniel Roer. All right, friends, let's close out with a band song. I'm going to play one of my favorite. This is it's kind of a soft song. See if I can find it here. All right, I'm going to play something from The Last Waltz. This is I Shall Be Released. Thank you so much for listening, friends. I hope you enjoyed that. I will talk to you very soon.
One more. I got Ringo and Ronnie Wood going to help us out on this one, too.
Yeah. It's a rock and roll geek train wreck.